This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 219, Do You Hear What I Hear? Hello and welcome again to yet another edition, a December edition of GamesAtWork.biz. This is Michael Martin. I'm delighted to be here with my co-host and great friend, Mr. Michael Rowe, on a chilly December day. Hey, Michael.
Hey. How you doing, Michael? I am doing awesome. Having a great time. We've got
your milk. You have your eggs.
We have bread. Our eggs. We have our milk. We have our bread. We have our blue and green different rock salts to cover our driveway.
Ooh.
We have our snow shovel.
Nice.
A party we're going to Saturday. We have an event we're supposed to be at on Sunday, and it's supposed to snow sometime starting Saturday night and go through Sunday. So
yep.
It might be a really relaxing weekend at home.
Yeah, we in North Carolina know how to do snow for sure, don't we?
We know how to do something.
Well, so we also know how to do games at work, and we have a fantastic lineup for all of you because we had a bit of a break in the action, so we kind of collected up the best of the news and information that we saw over the last week and change. And to get us our hearts pumping and the music thumping, the first article we have is from Ars Technica that was about some new technology that is a wearable that allows people to feel the tunes, to feel the music. I was super intrigued by this when I saw it because it was originally set up to help deaf people have an experience at a concert, a live concert event, and be able to feel the music more so than you can feel it with those enormous speakers around by wearing a specially constructed vest that transmits the music into your body through waves, essentially. So it's not the music like bone induction, but it is music in terms of waves that you can feel. I'd never seen anything like this before, and boy, I would love to try it, even though it looks a little goofy.
This is so cool, and it reminds me of something totally different and exactly the same. My conductor for my operas that I do in my copious free time just recently did a event at the North Carolina Museum of Art called a Silent Disco, and it was a fundraiser, and basically everybody comes in. There's music, there's lights and dance floor and everything else, but everybody wears headphones. And so the room is silent, but you see everybody just jamming out like they're at a disco, at a dance party, but you don't hear any sounds. And this same vibro-tactile technology, I think, would have kind of the same experience. So you could like go to a concert where you don't actually hear any sound outside of your own body. But because of the vibro-tactile experience, as they call it, everybody could be jamming to the music together, and people walking by would just see a bunch of people, kind of dancing to nothing.
You'd be kind of like living your own iPod commercial.
Yeah. This is so cool.
Those old
yes.
iPod commercials, right?
With the white headphones
with
and
the
silhouettes.
Yep.
Yeah, so that was kind of my first reaction to this. I mean, we've talked about the Bone conductive speaker set that used to be called the Bone, right? That you would hang around your neck, and it would have these heavy weighted speakers that actually did bone conduction for sound, so people next to you couldn't hear it, but it would vibrate your chest. I think this is similar to that,
right.
But at a more I'll say immersive level, right? The whole vest, as an example, being an immersive of your whole chest, not just, the top of your shoulders.
Right, right, and that's exactly the idea here too. So it's not conducting the music in the bone conductive sense like we were just talking about, but right. It's giving that but they called it vibrotactile, of the feeling that is on your wrist, that is on the lower part of your back,
yep.
Whole ranges of spaces and places, and it seems to me like what an intriguing way to experience a concert, and I can only imagine some of the bands like The Who or Zeppelin or
AC/DC, they call it out.
Rhapsody.
Have you seen it?
Oh, yeah.
It's on my list, and I still haven't had time to go see it. I'm so bummed.
Oh, well, a spoiler alert, they sing Bohemian Rhapsody in it.
What? okay, Siri's listening in on us.
Just... As into music as you and I are both, wouldn't this be cool? So I'm going to keep my eyes out for it. It is from a company called Not Impossible Labs, and the technology is called Music Not Impossible.
I want to put a link in the show notes. The Insight mission that landed 2 weeks ago, Monday now, has sent back and the tweet that I saw is actually wrong because it's the second example, Sound of Wind on Mars recording. Mm. And it is because the device that they're using to capture seismic vibration of the planet, right? Is actually picking up the seismic movement of the wind on top of the device before they put it in place. And it's at a such a super low frequency kind of subwoofer feeling level that in the tweet from Jim Bridenstine, he has the audio then taken up a couple of different octaves so that you can hear it in the tweet. So we're gonna put this in the show notes because it's that same thing of feeling the sound before you hear it,
yeah,
and experiencing it, and it's pretty cool. Got me down that same path.
Yeah, well, and maybe before we leave this, the other thing that struck me was the big call out here says the skin is the largest organ in the human body. So why not tap into that? Because the skin's sensitivity to shifts in intensity and amplitude is really big. So when you noodle on the notion of what you could do from a data visualization perspective, you can visualize data, not just in visual terms. We've talked about examples in the past of using audio to visualize data. So imagine you're sensing data and changes in data through your skin. So there could be lots of interesting ways to noodle on this for the future.
Yeah.
But let's stay on site for a minute as well as audio, because both of us, as it turned out, found the same subject article that has some intriguing aspects to it. Our friends up in Massachusetts over at Bose have come up with a pair of sunglasses looking, I don't know, I'll just say very Blues Brother-ish, that have some special characteristics to them.
Yes. And it's funny. I think we actually, when this first was kind of leaked last March, I think we talked about it back then too. Exactly. Yeah. So this is funny because, the article dubs it audio augmented reality.
And we had something similar to that too, if I remember.
Right. Yeah. And the point here that I find interesting is when I think of augmented audio reality, it's very personal. Right, I'm not going to share it with you because I've got earbuds in my ear. Right?
Oh, come on.
And these glasses actually break that rule. Right? They actually at the kind of where the arms of the glasses go behind your ear, right before it gets to your ear, it's much thicker because it's holding a lot of the electronics and the battery and everything. And then it kind of tapers back up and has a little arm go over your ear. Well, at that curve on the back side there, it has a little speaker grill. And that speaker grill actually pumps out the sound so that you can hear it. And, you know, I guess if I'm sitting there bopping down the road, listening to my tunes, have my sunglasses on, I could honestly ask, do you hear what I hear? Because the answer is probably yeah.
Well, so interestingly enough, in the span of time since we started the show notes and now, I've had a chance to look at Bose's website on these glasses that they call frames, kind of like spectacles from, you know, other vendors and so on. And they call it out as a personal audio device that is to provide discrete sound for the user and no one else. I mean, that's what they're saying.
That's what they're saying.
I think we need to experience that to know that that's exactly the case versus you've got an audio AR whispering in your ear. Oh, that's Michael.
It must be extremely directional. It must be extremely directional then, because they do say they're not using any type of bone conduction or conductive audio sound, right? It is a speaker.
Yeah.
And the point with the open grill like that is so that it doesn't block all the sounds around you. So when you're walking down the street, if you're listening like I do sometimes with the in-ear Bose noise-canceling headphones, you can be walking down a street and not hear a car come up behind you, which is a really bad idea, right?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
If you're wearing these out and about, you do want to hear ambient sounds around you. And so, like I said, it's got to be highly directional and really focused if it's going to be that I standing next to you, I can't hear what you hear.
Yeah, it would have to live into it that way. Well, we won't know for sure until South by Southwest or when they actually launch in January. So exciting times to be sure. And at the low price of $199, you know, they could be on a head near you, I suppose.
Which is really funny because to me, Bose was the $399 or $299 upgrade company, right? The original Bose Quiet Comforts, I think, were $299. My bookshelf speakers, I think, were either $299 or $399. So $199 because they're smaller. I get it.
Yeah. Well, very, 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 very cool. And I think I've figured out what the pin is, because at first I was like, is that a way to
maybe it's
interact?
Charging?
It's a charging pin, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's what that is. That's on the underarm of the glass frame that's going to your ears.
Yeah.
All right. So staying true to vision and what can be seen or maybe obscured a little bit when you're wearing these fear-sensitive glasses, another article that came up in our hit parade was what Tesla sees when it's on the road. So I've certainly been intrigued. I know you have too, around artificial intelligence recently and the whole structure around augmented cars and automated driving and such. So there is an example of 17-minute video that actually.
Have you been on this stretch of road?
Well, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this.
Okay,
because
I
figured
this
stretch of road.
You had. As soon as I saw it, I was like, you've been on this. You have to have been on this stretch of road.
So the road is called the Tail of the Dragon, and it is a highway. I believe it's Highway 128. I would have to look and be absolutely sure, between North Carolina and Tennessee, that has somewhere 320-plus loopbacks on it. And it is super extremely fun to drive. And you can have an enjoyable experience on this particular road, unless you are behind a car that is poking along and not moving very quickly, like someone who is using GPS to say, oh, I need to get from this part of North Carolina to this part of Nebraska, and this is the shortest calculated route. So I will take my semi and go on this road. Oopsie daisy. Maybe I shouldn't have done that.
I think the quick phrase at that point is, what the hell was I thinking?
Yeah.
With 318 loopbacks.
I'm seeing it. I'm remembering it almost exactly. So super, super cool road to be on. And what I liked about this hack of the Tesla environment is the linkages of how all the camera lenses are interacting with one another. It's almost a little bit like a fly or a bee, you know, how they're seeing the world. That's what it kind of struck me, to be able to understand the surroundings and then make adjustments on them, recognizing cars for cars and motorcycles for motorcycles and doing the appropriate adjustments for the curves in the road and the how it's going up and down as well. Cause, when I do this road, I'm usually somewhere between second and third gear, and that's it. You know, you're not going much faster than that, and you can't go a whole heck of a lot slower. So, you said you'd watched some of the video too, because it's I wouldn't say it was monotonous. It was kind of a lot of the same thing. Because once you've seen about 20 or 40 curves, you kind of have an opinion of what the next 100 are going to look like, right?
Well, it was really interesting to me because, as you know, back in 2014, 2015, I actually was working as an offering manager in connected vehicles.
So
this whole space is something very near and dear to my heart. I still work with the team that does a lot of work with the automotive industry in my day job around connected vehicles, understanding driving behavior and other really, really cool algorithms where this type of data is relevant, right? And the fact that they've taken and done a 360 degree visualization of all the video and stitch it together really shows you how complete modern vehicles are when it comes to sensor packages. And not only do they do a really good job nowadays of understanding vehicles coming at you or things on the side of the road, but also lanes, route of the road, right? I mean, you see on the video, you see this red line, which is don't pass over this red line because you're going to go into oncoming traffic. That's the center line, which is actually a computer vision drawing in between the two solid yellow lines on the road, right? So that doesn't obviously exist on the road. You also see different color gradations understanding the shape of the asphalt of the road versus the grass on the side of the road. What it does with contrasts in order to understand and read street signs and segment the street sign away from maybe a branch that is sitting up against it from being on the side of the road, right? Coming from a tree. The technology, the ability not only to visualize this, but to do it at such a frame rate, real time, to in real time see all this, classify it using artificial intelligence and machine learning, and then process that into a system of the vehicle to do something else with, which, of course, they're not doing anything else with it in this video, right? They're just looking at all the data that comes off the car. But things like driver assist and understanding when the car is about to drift out of a lane, all that happens in real time in a modern car today because of what you see in this video. Really cool.
Yeah, so watching the video, there was a couple other things that kind of struck me. Maybe with your background, you know more about this as well. One of the things that struck me was the algorithms for self-driving identify that, hey, there are vehicles behind me. In the case here was a couple of motorcycles that the AI in the car goes, I need to pull over and let them pass me. So to me, that was an intriguing thing because being on this road with cars that are poking along in front of you is kind of painful and you want to be able to get around them and move at a good clip. So having the AI recognize that I thought was really an intriguing thing to move over to the side of the road and allow the vehicles behind to pass. Is that something you've encountered before, too, how to make those decisions? Or?
My understanding of this video, the AI didn't do that. That was the driver. I think the driver is just capturing the data off of the sensors. He's driving the vehicle. They're not using autopilot. They're just acquiring the data that autopilot sees.
Got it.
The way I read the article, that was the case because Autopilot is going to, which we know is just advanced driver assist, right? It's not autopilot. It's going to obey the rules of the road and then address the situational awareness of those things around it. Lane drift, one of the reasons that works is if you are about to cross over the line and you have not turned on your turn signal, signaling intent to go around something, that is considered lane drift, and the car will auto-correct back towards the center of the lane. Matter of fact, this week I was actually talking to a couple of people at our favorite coffee shop one morning, and the guy was complaining that his car's lane drift kept bugging him when he would try to go around people. And I'm like, well, it won't if you use your turn signal. And he goes, well, I didn't really need to use the turn signal then. And I'm like, well, that's your problem. You're not obeying the rules of the road. You absolutely have to. Because it would fight them. It would say, hey, you're trying to go over. You're not supposed to.
Well, and now that explains a little bit more, too, because watching the video, there were absolutely segments of this where the car moved over both double yellow lines into the wrong lane. And on the narrow tail of the dragon, while some people joke that, you know, my lane is up until the bleeding edge of the second yellow line, and that's what I have access to. Not really. you want to stay in your lane.
If both cars in each direction had that same belief, both cars would have part of their car missing.
That's how your rearview mirror decides it's going to take a one-way vacation.
Yes.
All right. Well, awesome. This is really intriguing to stitch together the way a car might see this, and then also just to be able to log the video and the driver's habits, because the car then could machine learn its way into what is the driver comfortable with and what might they be saying, hey, this is how I prefer to drive, so don't be any more spirited or aggressive than this, or pull over to the side of the road if you're sensing that there are cars behind you that really want to go a lot faster. So loving the AI aspects to it. Super cool.
Yeah.
Continuing on the thought, and we started having this conversation in the pre-show, and I was like, no, hold it. Wait, you've got an idea. I want to talk about it. There was an article from Inverse about the notion that as more and more cars, like the Tesla vehicles, electric cars, are coming into production and use, they're going to change the nature of oil, gasoline, diesel consumption, and create stressors on the electric grid to an extent that the electric grid may not have been scaled and prepared for. So you had a perspective here that I said, hey, wait, let's save it to the show. We're here. So
it was an interesting article, and it starts off, if you watch the video at the beginning, they actually had a group of scientists do a study on the amount of carbon footprint over the entire life cycle of a vehicle, comparing a gas-powered vehicle versus an electric vehicle. So this is the actual manufacturing process. And during the manufacturing process, the electric vehicle used about 1 metric ton more, or caused about 1 metric ton more of carbon emissions versus a gas car because of the manufacturing process of the battery itself, right? So all things being equal. Then they looked at the lifespan of driving the vehicle, and then they looked at, you know, decommissioning the vehicle, so tearing it apart, whatever. Okay. So over the entire lifespan, a gas vehicle generates 57 metric tons of carbon emissions. An electric vehicle, including generation of electricity, right?
Yep.
Used, I think it was either 22 or 23 metric tons. And then the comment was, and that would be a gas-powered vehicle even at 50 miles per gallon.
Right.
Okay, so highly efficient gas vehicle, 57 metric tons versus 22, 23 metric tons. So that kind of set the stage for my reading of the rest of the article, which says I would have to generate significantly more electricity. And they were comparing the difference between Texas and California on how to generate all the electricity demand in order to charge these electric vehicles.
Yep.
And the challenge is that California, because of the varyingness of its climate from north to south, would really have a struggle to get to the power they need.
Yep.
However, if you think about what the electric generating companies in this country have been doing for the last 50 years, we've always been kind of in a state that we keep building more and more things that need the power that these generating utilities generate. So to me, the issue is not where, you know, is it going to have a big impact on the grid? Everything's going to have a big impact on the grid. We are constantly building more stuff that uses electricity. The grid needs to keep up. The impact of this article to me is much more about carbon usage and emissions than it is about can the grid keep up, because the grid has to keep up. It just has to.
Well, it does. I think for me, the interesting angle, there's several, but one of them was that the increased demand for electricity is going to accelerate because of the proliferation of electric vehicles. It's not a question of are they good or bad, or they consume or create more carbon emissions than non-electric vehicles. There's plenty of work on that tells the story. And you would have to believe that the various electric producing companies out there are doing this kind of analysis to plan for future demand and recognize where in the country that demand needs to be created in anticipation of what the demand is going to be. So that's sort of the given there. So if we're making the safe assumption that more and more electric vehicles are going to hit the grid, and they require the charging, especially overnight charging, which will change also the cycle of when electric demand is happening. That is an intriguing notion too, when you consider also what's cooking around on the solar front about self-generation of power and the incentives that go along with that. In addition to
so here's
using,
a thought.
You know,
you just triggered, I think, the thought that solves this.
Yeah.
Germany has the issue right now that their grid is degrading because so many people are using solar and are trying to contribute it to the grid instead of pulling off the grid. So if you can drive home usage to self-generation, then the grid can be used for electric vehicle charging.
Yeah, it could be.
That's a huge offload, right?
Well, and remember, gosh, this is now years ago, and I'm fuzzy on it. There was a former chief technology officer from SAP that went to an electric vehicle company that was focused on using the batteries in electric vehicles as an overnight consumption structure. So stick with me here. It's sunny.
I remember this.
Right? You power your car, you power the battery of your car from the sun, and then you discharge energy from the car overnight while the sun's down. So you're powering your home, self-generation that way. And then when the electricity prices are very low, you recharge it so you can get to your office in the morning.
Yeah. I think what I seem to remember was slightly different, and maybe this is just my memory, but it was hybrid vehicles because you could actually generate electricity from the gas engine even. Maybe I'm making that up, but in a hybrid situation, when
your generator is your car,
your generator is the car, and when when solar is cheap and available, you could run off a battery. When it's not, you run off a gas and you charge the battery. When you park it overnight, you would then offload the excess battery in the car into the house for consumption, thereby cutting out your peaks and valleys on the overall grid.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, right. And again, I'm not remembering it fully, but these things are all in here. And maybe one last comment before we click along, because we know we're running out of time and there's so much to talk about. I've been seeing some interesting discussions about what happens post the car's life cycle. So you brought this up earlier, Michael. We're going to have enormous amounts of batteries from vehicles that are going to enter the reverse supply chain, that something has to be done with them, right? So what do you do with batteries that no longer hold the charge that they need to? Think about your phone or your laptop or whatever. Now we're dealing with that on a car size basis. There's another intriguing angle there of where the puck is going to be and what needs to happen to handle all those batteries from electric cars once they're done with their life cycle.
Yeah, and I think this is why the promise of fuel cell was so attractive.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Because the output waste product is water.
right. Ah, intriguing. All right, so we've got precious little time to continue, but we've got a couple more things we want to get in, one of which is a tattoo. So we've had intriguing ideas on what can be put on people's skin. Funny, interesting, intriguing example of a customized tattoo, which is just a tattoo that is coupled with an AR experience, so that when your phone looks at it, it creates a Sonic the Hedgehog world right there through your phone. And I saw this and I thought, wow, that's pretty slick. And I clicked through the article and read a little bit more about it, and I thought that was neat. So visual thing, have a look.
Yeah.
Go.
Yeah, another kind of visual thing. Have a look. Go check it out. Creative has just announced, and actually it goes live, I think, this weekend in a beta environment. Fortnite. It's not Creative. What's the name of the company that does Fortnite? Anyway, doesn't really matter. It's Fortnite.
Yes.
Fortnite is enabling creative mode this weekend, starting on December 6th. That's not today, is it? No, that was yesterday. Oh, my God. It was yesterday.
Yeah.
I don't know what day it is. It's the weekend. Fortnite has announced creative mode, which allows you to basically be like a Second Life island and build your own environments. $10 a month. This is over on New World Notes, one of the old blogs from the Second Life days by Wagner James. Go check it out. This looks really exciting, especially for people who are doing machinima.
Yeah, super cool stuff. Super cool. And that's going to open up a whole lot more for where we need to go. The last one that we'll close on is a Cockatoo article about playing games in these virtual environments. And this particular one was extolling on the advantages of being a healer in games that are places where you need a healer in your party, and how cool it is to be one. So... Do you play as a healer often, Michael? Because I never do.
On World of Warcraft, I have lots of different tunes, right? And one of them is a healer, but I don't heal. So you can be a priest, and a priest has most of all the classes, right, have different specializations. One of them be heal, one will be damage, you know, DPS. The other one might be DPS or tank, blah, 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 right?
Right.
I find healing to be really, really hard, because you have to pay attention to everybody and everything. And if you're on a quest or in a dungeon or in a, you know, a big boss fight or a world event, if you don't have good healers, you don't have squat. I don't care how good a tank you have. I don't know how good your DPS is. You need that healer, and they're the ones that keep the game going, and I'm not good at it. But I saw this article. I thought it was a great way of kind of defining what makes healers special.
Yeah. Well, and they are, and for many games you can't succeed without good ones, and like any diverse cross-functional team, you need everything together.
Yep.
All right. So I think that's where we have to leave it for today. Thanks for listening. Looking forward to seeing you next week, and talk to you later. See ya.
Bye.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.